two things. One, the Rooney Rule. While I commend people for starting there, that's what it is. It's a start. So we have to tap into those networks. So I agree with you. But the Rooney Rule to me is cute. It's like having one Black friend. We want to make sure you're not just checking the box and moving on. And also, diversity is not defined by a bunch of white women, right? So we have to think about multiculturalism or intersectionality when we're thinking about diversity.
Angela, yeah, I totally agree with you 100%. And by the way, on the Rooney Rule, there's a really important point here. Is having one person from a diverse group on your team is not solving diversity. In fact, it almost makes it worse.
Hey, everybody. This is Alec Davis, editor-in-chief of PitchBook News, and welcome back to Invisible Capital. In this episode, we're going to feature a discussion about race and the evolving role of investors addressing racial inequality in their investments and in the management of their firms. We thought it was worth resurfacing this insightful conversation because even as Black History Month comes to an end, the hard work to increase diversity in the markets goes on. For years, pressure has mounted on investors to change their practices around diversity and inclusion. That movement got a game-changing push following last year's unrest over racial injustice. But there is a lot more work to be done by corporate boards, C-suites, and investment committees to increase diversity and address racial inequality. Investors are taking up a closely watched opportunity for change, but navigating and fostering racial diversity is fraught with challenges and uncertainty. Our guests from across the investment ecosystem joined us to share their own views and experience grappling with race and diversity. I was joined by Hillary Wick, a senior analyst at PitchBook, and our four guests: Lisa Lambert, head of National Grid Partners, the venture and innovation arm of National Grid. In her previous role at Intel Capital, Lisa created and led the Intel Diversity Fund. Barry Eggers, a partner at Lightspeed Venture Partners and current chairman of the National Venture Capital Association. Angela Matheny, who leads the Diverse Asset Manager Program at Crucial Partners, an investment consulting firm formerly known as Colonial Consulting. And Cynthia Muller, head of mission-driven investment with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, overseeing a $100 million portfolio of impact investments. Our chat began with Hillary posing the first question to National Grid's Lisa Lambert.
Yeah, so let's start with Cynthia and Lisa. We'll have Lisa go first. Why should race and equity be a focal point of concern for partners of PE and VC firms, as well as other asset managers?
Well, primarily because we are charged with investing in underserved markets. And if you don't have representation across all of the communities, those underserved markets, I'm not sure how you can actually invest in them. You need to have representation on your general partner teams, your investment teams, across the LP base. That enables us to do our job, which is to find these underserved markets and develop technology and implement technology to serve them. So I think that's fundamental. And I think there is this perception that the pipeline isn't sufficient to actually hire people of color into these roles. And I think that's a fallacy as well. I think one of the things that I learned when we launched the Intel Capital Diversity Fund is when you tell people that you're looking for people of color, and that's explicitly what we did, we actually launched a $125 million fund targeting people of color and women. And we put the shingle out on the door. We did a press conference. We did lots of articles. We did lots of interviews. And lo and behold, when we did that, we got over 600 business plans from people of color and women in the first 2 months. And so I think part of the reason that we don't see that diversity is because I think many people of color and women don't think that the door is open for them. But when you let them know the door is open for them and you actually pursue them, you will find more than you can imagine. There are a lot of Black entrepreneurs, a lot of women entrepreneurs that are looking for capital, just don't think they can get it from the traditional sources. And so I think making that known and then being aggressive about it, don't go back to the normal networks, don't go back to the normal recruiters. If you want diversity, you have to go look for it, but it is out there.
Terrific. So Cynthia, from your perspective as an LP, why do you think race and equity should be a focal point for asset managers?
Well, I would echo everything Lisa has to say. And I would also add, for us at the Kellogg Foundation, which is about a $9 billion endowment, private foundation endowment, you know, we have the privilege of having this mission built into all of our work, as well as managing the more enormous assets of the foundation. And over the last 13 years or so, we really started having those intersections meet. And so one of the things that we realized is that we needed to be more focused on racial equity and the aspiration of racial equity. And the reason being is that if we don't start to look at these systems that we're all operating in and all that, and the systems that we all learned more and more about this year, right, and how they operate and how they don't work for all of us, we realize that we are truly at only at a 1D dimension, right, around investment. We're only looking in a one-dimensional way, right? We're not looking at the additional layers of complexity and externalities that really impact the way that we operate in this society. So when we see products that are being made that only target, you know, people who are college graduates when the majority of the country isn't, right, you're missing a market, right? And so for us, it's really thinking about how can we expand the dimensions of how we think about investments holistically, and how do we think about that management practice in-house, right? Because we agree that diversity is absolutely paramount, but we don't think that is the goal. The goal is racial equity. That's the aspiration. We want to see equity throughout for women, for Black and brown people. But we also want to see the capital markets open up in a way that where we can see opportunity in a much more holistic way, and where we can find people in a much more tactical way versus this more, you know, transactional, you know, you happen to be brown, Black, or woman, right? You're a hot commodity right now. And I think we really have to look beyond that, right? We have to think about how do we keep people in the institutions? How do we keep these entrepreneurs afloat? How do we think about our roles and the power that we have as LPs and the influence that we use every day? And how can we use that a little bit differently? So for us, it's around expanding an opportunity, but it's also about thinking about all of those millions of folks that are left out of the capital markets that, you know, have an incredible potential, as well as many of the markets that we've been focusing on until now.
Well, we're going to dive into that some more, but I want to turn to Barry for a moment. Barry, as a general partner, how do you view the role and responsibility of your firm and sort of accommodating or taking into incorporating the racial equity aspirations of the stakeholders of your firm, such as LPs, employees, and your portfolio companies?
Well, when we think about participation and representation in our ecosystem, we think about for Black and Latinx and Pacific Islander and Indigenous minorities, we think about involvement in employment in our firm. We think about in the investment team and non-investment team, we think about the founders that we're backing, the boards of those companies, the execs in those companies, the employees in those companies. We think about our LPs, and we think about the cap tables for those companies that we're investing in. And so all those things are part of what we like to think of as representation in our ecosystem. And you know, to go back to your first question, why is this important? We think about income inequality in the United States. Well, guess what? If you look at the top five valued companies in the world, they're all tech companies. A lot of income and wealth has been created in the innovation ecosystem, and largely Black, Latinx, Indigenous, Pacific Islanders have been left behind in that ecosystem. That's why this is important.
So it's a sustainability issue for society and the economy, isn't it?
Well, it's a sustainability issue, and it's a factor in income inequality. For us, I don't like to use the word accommodating. I want to win. I want to generate the best gains that I can, best performance I can as a fund. And guess what? What we know is that if we have a bunch of white males in our firm, guess what? We're going to go and reach out to a bunch of white male entrepreneurs. If we have women in our firm as investors, guess what? We reach more women entrepreneurs. If we have Black and Latinx investors in our firm, we reach more Black and Latinx entrepreneurs. The more entrepreneurs you reach, the more deals you see, the more deals you see, the better deals you do, the better deals you do, the better your performance is. So we want to reach as many entrepreneurs as we can. So we have to look like the population as a firm.
So Angela and Cynthia, the three of us have all spent a lot of our careers, I think, assessing asset managers. I was an investment consultant and an institutional investor as well. And I think we all could say that it's pretty unusual, or no, it's not unusual for us to be the only woman in the room, or for you, the only person of color in the room. Many in the investment ecosystem say they'd love to improve their diversity profile, but the candidate pool just isn't qualified for the positions they're trying to fill. Is this a pipeline problem, as in women and people of color aren't getting the right training to be qualified? Or is this a problem with the definition of being qualified? Angela, why don't you start?
Thank you. I think it's both. I think that if we don't create opportunities in corporate America in general, then people will not get the opportunities and the training that they need. When I look at some of the managers that are in our diverse manager pipeline, I think of managers such as William Hurd of Hurd Capital out of Chicago. And I think that if we don't appreciate his differentiated talent, what he's bringing to our roster, and how we measure him against other managers when we're looking to do something different and build better portfolios. If we don't give him access to capital, then how is he supposed to create the talent that we say that we're trying to find that we don't see? People, women tend to hire people that look like themselves. And so we have to create opportunity. There is no, I really become unnerved when people say that we can't find them, because I always say that we're not hiding. You have to tap into those networks. I mean, we're hearing a lot today about, you know, HBCUs and all of these resources that we've now all of a sudden come to know that we can tap into as it relates to talent, but they've always been there. And so one of the things that we've done at Crucial was we've broken down barriers that we may have had as a firm. And we all have biases. So we identified them. We even brought in the great Dr. Jane Elliott to give us a really hard conversation about race and how America, you know, was built, and how does everyone play in that? And, you know, the definition of race is just ridiculous, because there's just one race, the human race. And so a lot of us never heard that before, not me, but my, you know, colleagues. And so what we've done is we've managed our biases. And one of the things that our CIO would say if he were here was enough research already. Start the process, tap into an ecosystem. So something that I've done is I've been given a huge budget to partner with various trade organizations. I hit the ground running. I did nothing. I think I traveled more than maybe the consultants at the job. And I showed up at a lot of conferences, and I created a network, and I found the talent that many people say that is not out there. So what we need to do is stop debating about is there talent, and just go out and start talking about talking to different people and break that pattern recognition as it relates to old networks, fish in a new pond, and have healthy debates at your firm and challenge your colleagues.
Yeah, I don't know how many times in all my manager research days, people thought it was a selling point to say, we go to all the top business schools. I'm like, what about the number one at Michigan, or the number one at small private school in Tacoma, Washington? You know, those people deserve to be looked at, and they're probably better than the 1,000th person at Harvard. So, sorry, Cynthia, your turn.
It's about perception of risk, right? And who defines that? And it's been defined in one, again, one dimension, right? And so I think for us, it's helping us to understand, what additional risk are we taking, right? And how do we contextualize that risk relative to where these managers are at? So for instance, you know, a lot of us have GP commitments. Black and brown managers are not able to come up with GP commitments. They're not gonna have those assets. So for us, what we did, we said, all right, you know, we asked a question, where is it coming from? Folks say, we did this and that. We don't try and have them adjust the GP commitment. We wanna understand, is it appropriate for them and where they're at? And, you know, because we're not trying to, you know, have people bankrupt themselves, you know, to do this, especially folks who are already kind of catching up in a lot of respects within this particular industry. I also think, you know, there's research that's out there. You can look at the Stanford report. Dr. Eberhardt did some great work research on this. I think of a couple of years, he was, it's not a diverse, it's not a pipeline issue. They are out there. It's truly how our brains look at lists and we go and gravitate to what we like, right? And so it's about us thinking about the fluidity of work, right? Every day we make decisions. Every day we have to make those decisions based on the context, right? Based on COVID, based on the markets, based on what we know, right? What we are saying is that you have to layer in racial equity. Racial equity is just as much of a risk if you're not paying attention to it as if you were not like not looking at, you know, key man, because we've seen it. We've seen the business risk. You can't tell me that, you know, when someone gets called out on for, you know, a racist whatever on Twitter, it doesn't affect their share, just the share price or affect the image and brand that they're trying to attain. I also think too, as we think about risk, we also have to, you know, really get down and define it, right? So one of the benefits of the field I come from, impact investing, is done a lot of kind of breaking that down. And we did it, we can go into great detail and probably more than anybody ever wants to know. But I think for us at the Kellogg Foundation, it really has helped us to think about how tactical do we want to be? How narrow with some of our managers? So for instance, with some of our first time, second time fund managers, particularly those that are underrepresented, you know, a lot of it is around connections and introducing them to new people. And that's what we do. We just connect, right? And really helping our managers get access to the entirety of our platform, not only on our 20-person investment team, but the rest of the foundation that include PhD, brilliant policy people, researchers, and helping them to kind of think about how do you really address these system, really critical system issues with these tools. And so really breaking down the barriers of what we as an LP would, or what a typical LP would look like, right? Because, you know, we're doing racial equity, you know, training. We provide our managers some resources to help them figure out how to have these conversations or even just navigate it themselves, right? I did a fun call with one manager earlier this year in May who was literally like, I just kind of gingerly offered like a little, you know, session with a couple of my portfolio and everyone's going to attend and I don't know what to say. And so, you know, and walking them through. And so I was like, be yourself. Here are the things to say. Here are the things not to say, but just be yourself, right? And here are some resources. But to, you know, our managers who need help with this, thinking through some pivots, right? And resourcing them with some of those partners. So I think it's not only the diversity and getting, you know, more people like that look more like the population. I think it's that and thinking about how do we show up? How do we show up as LPs? How do we show up with our power and influence? Not just to go and say we're in the deal, but really truly to be additive to those entrepreneurs to make them successful, not only today, but for the future. And that includes having a healthy understanding of our society, and that includes racial equity.
Thanks, Cynthia. Let me bring up the subject of fiduciary duty. And Barry, you touched on this already, I think, with your answer, but I'm going to ask you, how do you respond to people who say you need to hire the best people and strive for the best investment results?
Yeah, we do. And that's why I said we gotta also reach as many entrepreneurs as we can to produce the best results. We don't do that with a team of white men. We do that with a diverse team, a team that reflects the population. So that's what we're striving to do. Let me just go back, and I feel like a politician right now because I'm going to answer the previous question, not the one you just asked, but I will come back to your question on the whether it's an access or a pipeline issue. I think if we accomplish one thing today, let's put an end to the question of whether it's a pipeline issue. It's not a pipeline issue. There's 330 million people in the United States. It's not a pipeline issue. We know for a fact, and I've experienced it, we have a scout program where we go off and we have people outside of Lightspeed invest on our behalf to reach a broader network. We give them $250,000 and they invest and they get most of the gains from those investments. This year, we decided we were going to do it 100% racial minority. So we put the word out through our network and in 2 weeks, and we wanted to target 25 individuals. We put the word out in our network, and in 2 weeks, we had 350 people express interest. We were overwhelmed. Great candidates. So much so that we increased it to 42, which we thought was the sort of the total capacity we could have without making it a, without making the experience poorer, but it's also Jackie Robinson's number. So we went with 42 candidates. My point of that is there are candidates out there. This is not a pipeline issue, it's an access issue. And so how do we make access better? Well, you know, what the one thing we did is we gave them candidates a place to go where they could express interest. And guess what? They went there. So we should be talking not about pipeline issues, but access issues. And again, that to come back to your question, our fiduciary duty is to find a way to reach as many of our the best candidates as possible. So you don't reach all the best candidates by going to Stanford and Harvard. You got to go to other places and you got to find ways to do that. We've got to develop an ecosystem that allows and enables our industry to do that. We're already doing it at Lightspeed, but other firms we got to have an ecosystem to do that, period.
Angela, what are some resources and methods for sourcing investment products run by people of color? And what to use a reasonable level of diversity to qualify? I know that I would go out and find managers that were owned by people of color, but maybe their entire investment staff was back to being white male. So how do you decide what qualifies as an investment product that would meet your diversity qualifications?
It's not so much the product. We like unique opportunities. We're contrarian investors. And so if the product fits our investment philosophy, if it's something that we're not avoiding, because I source across 5 asset classes. And so if it fits our investment philosophy and you're investing in a way that we think you should be investing, but we can see that differentiation and that unique edge that you bring, then we're going to want to learn more. But I connect with people on LinkedIn all the time. I cold DM people. I have our clients sending inbounds all of the time. We have a place on our website where you can upload your deck and connect with us that way. I get calls from all sorts of people in my network. But I wanted to take a step back and also say that it's really important to curate talent. And so for those of us who believe in diverse cohorts of internship programs, I think that that is another way to develop the talent. So you can do that on one end of the spectrum. And then on the other end, you have to see who's ready in the industry for your client, for our client's capital, I'll say, because we're an institutional investor that manages over $35 billion for all nonprofit institutions, and they have to exist in perpetuity. And so I said on a prep call that I love what Cynthia is doing, because her organization is doing a lot of the heavy lifting. And I would love to tap into an ecosystem where we can sort of do a handoff for those early, what we would deem as early investors. If we're talking about venture capital, I see a lot of managers that are just really early. What I started doing was things like triage and prepping them for meetings, not telling them what to say, but to, you know, sort of tap into the personalities of maybe team members, what you're going to face. We're going to ask highly technical questions. If you don't understand a question, I mean, I've had that, then we can rephrase a question. But the other part of this is really critical feedback, giving that critical feedback, because I find in my Black community that we just want to know what we don't know. And I find that is the same across all ethnicities and especially women. I don't think you should fall into this Black hole of not knowing why someone is not going to give you feedback after spending 90 minutes with you at a meeting. It's just not fair.
Great points.
Should I add something on that?
Oh, please.
I think that I love what Angela's doing, because I think it also shows too that, you know, beyond the investment, right, we have to think about how do we continue to be supportive, right? Not only just expecting the investees to be brilliant and, you know, and do what they do, but also thinking about where those gaps are, right? Because a lot of these folks are coming either out of old careers, new careers, what have you. But I think everybody's coming at a different point. And I think as we are realizing the ways that our interconnectivity really influences, you know, our output in the sense of, you know, what you see is what you get, right? So if you're only looking for, you know, this discrete type of a person, that is what you're going to get. And so I think for us, we've started to break it down into, you know, is it a representation play? is this a strategy play, right? So at a representation level, it's just straight up, are we looking at underrepresented at a strategy? How are they actually starting to bring this lens into their strategy? So great example is Impact America Fund, which we invested in last year. One of the largest Black-owned female VC funds in the country now. And quite frankly, Keisha, this is technically her second fund, $55 million. And she came in, and to Angela's point, she's like, okay, tell me what I don't know. And we did. And she ran out, resourced herself. And I think for her, it really helped her to go through that experience. But also for us, it helped us to think about how can we help to shorten that timeline even more. So I just really love what Angela's doing. I think it's something that it's not a heavy lift in a lot of ways. It's just asking a couple more questions and really digging into the experience of your potential investee.
And I also want to add that you have to know and sort of take the temperature and see when people want to be vulnerable, but maybe they don't think that they can be vulnerable with an LP. I'm a real girl from Brooklyn. I connect well with my people, with women. I'm a very social person. And so a lot of the part of my triage entails breaking things down. You can talk to me. Let's talk, because this is a mission. And we all want to play in this space. I want to give managers the ability to compete. And so asking what you need to know, maybe it's not a no in terms of our overview. Maybe it's not a not right now, but you can come back and we can keep talking. And the importance of keep talking is that you have to realize that you need to build a relationship. So I'm great at building relationships. A lot of my relationships start over LinkedIn. You can come back and forth with me. I can always DM you. You can email me. We can get on a call. And I'm always on a conference circuit. So I think that one of the things that we have definitely changed at Crucial Partners is accessibility. I'm very approachable, and my colleagues are as well. You may not see them as much as you see me, but when you get a seat at the table, once you do come in for that meeting, you're going to be so amazed at what you see, a diverse team. And one other thing I want to say is that it's really important for our investment team to be diverse as well, because I need everyone to appreciate this differentiated talent that we're seeing. One of the investments that Keisha Cash talks about a lot in her portfolio is Maveen hair extensions. I'm about to go into my hair extension style protection mode. If you don't understand that market and the huge opportunity that lies there for consumers, you are missing out on something really great. And so just because you may not wear hair extensions doesn't mean that there's not a market and an appreciation for that product and the consumers.
All right. Thanks, Angela. I want to turn for a second to Lisa, please. So you were talking about the unique access and impact that you can make. Regarding early stage companies that are the least mature, they're smaller, do you think that as such, they are in a unique position to make an impact in the course of diversity in the ecosystem? Do they have a particular quality by being so small and early in their development?
I don't know if there's anything unique to being small that makes it more open to diversity. I think, again, it goes back to what markets are you pursuing? Some of the comments that we've heard today, venture capitalists are supposed to pursue underserved markets. And a lot of these underserved markets, like the hair extensions business that was just mentioned, people that don't use hair extensions aren't going to think about that market. And so if you want to pursue markets that are non-traditional markets, that are underserved markets, then you need to have representatives from those communities. It's pretty straightforward. And I think, I've seen a lot of startups that have diverse teams that are pursuing some of these underserved markets, and they do tend to be more diverse. And if you get the leadership team that's more diverse, then you're probably going to have entrepreneurs that are more diverse, and you're probably going to have associates and principals that are more diverse. So I think there is an opportunity there if you're going after the market, but I think it has much more to do with the market than the size or the stage of the company. I think it's more about what markets are you pursuing. And, people of color need to feel like they're empowered and that they can get funding to go after these markets. And I think historically, venture capital firms have not given them that sense of empowerment because the capital hasn't been available to those startups. And I think it's not available because if you look at most GPs and most venture capital firms, they don't have women and they don't have Blacks and they don't have Latinos and they don't have, you know, they have some Asians, but they don't have the Pacific Islanders. And so you're not going to go after those startups if you don't have representation because you aren't in those networks. And so stage isn't really it. I think it's really more about how you're building your team and how you view the market opportunities that exist. If you're going with traditional, then you're basically going to continue to pursue, you know, white males. If you're going with non-traditional, underserved markets, then you have the option to go after teams that look different. And I think that's what every general partnership needs to decide for itself, whether it's going to be serious about doing that. And in order to be serious about doing that, you actually do have to go with the talent. The talent is there.
Can I add one other thing? I think what I love about what Lisa's pointing to is also the lived experience, right? So we're talking about people. This is like, break it down. So it's not only about getting people who represent that aren't, who are underrepresented in this industry, but it's also about those experiences too, right? So my experience as an Indigenous Alaskan Native Black woman growing up in Alaska, going to Stanford and flying over the country is going to be vastly different, right, than, you know, Lisa's experience, right? And so I think thinking about, you know, the experience, the career path is fundamentally different. I think we have to Barry's point, get out of the school name piece of it and really look at what have these people done? Because people have been hustling and the moment is here. And I think what's been beautiful about a lot of these conversations and kind of these hopeful conversations that we've been having over the last 9 months, as we think about what's possible, I think what's really interesting is that there's been so much innovation and so much opportunity in this field, and that folks just need the agency. Give them the cash and let them do what they need to do and get out of the way and add whatever they need you to add. And I think that's really hard to do as LPs because I think a lot of us have ego in this, right? I do. I certainly do, right? And I think we want to be additive, but we don't know how to be. And I think it really requires us as LPs and investors to be a little more introspective. How are we showing up? Are we actually being helpful, right? Like, people laugh at all our jokes. We're not that funny. Come on. So I think, like, we really need to start to layer that in. I think about that experience. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of the VC industry has already taken us in some ways. I think we just need to dig in a little deeper, get outside of ourselves.
Great. Barry, at the GP level, what kind of things can a firm do to proactively target investment opportunities at companies whose founders are people of color?
Yeah, good question. And we're seeing a lot of questions about, okay, you guys are talking about a lot of good stuff. What are you doing? And I'm a firm believer that actions speak louder than words, and you got to be judged by your actions, not your words. There's a lot of words out there today, but not as many actions. How do you reach founders, Black founders, Latinx founders? Bottom line is you have Black and Latinx investors on your team. That's the best way. I mean, you can't tell a bunch of white males to go do more investing in white females or Black males or Black females, or it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen naturally. You know, we have 10 women on our investment team now. And I think that's more than any other venture firm. And we reach a lot of female entrepreneurs. We have 3 Black investors. We need more for sure. And we need more Latinx investors, but we're now starting to reach a network. And now with our Scout program, 100% are racial minority. We actually are reaching a broader set of entrepreneurs. That's what you can do, but your team has to reflect it. You can't just say you're going to go find those people with the same team. You actually have to change your team.
Can you elaborate a bit on what your Scout program's about?
Yeah, and I mentioned it before, but again, we've been doing this for about 3 or 4 years, and we find people outside of Lightspeed that have good networks, and we give them money to invest, our money to invest on our behalf in deals that we wouldn't normally see outside our network. So typically outside of the Bay Area and outside of our people network. And this year we said we were gonna have all of our scouts be racial minorities. And so they are. We have 42 scouts, they're 60% Black, 30% Latinx, and 10% Pacific Islander and Indigenous. And we have a curriculum and content that they can opt into if they'd like. We form them into teams. We connect them with Lightspeed teams, and we create little sort of virtual firms so they can learn venture capital. And someone said, well, you know, one of the problems is finding a job in venture. People ask your track record. Well, yeah, that's right. So with Scouts, you actually, you know, $250,000, you can make up to 10 investments. You can actually start developing a track record. And so, again, this is all the stuff that needs to happen. The candidates are out there. We have to provide the access. And the access also means providing the ability to start generating a track record. And so we're doing that with 42 Scouts. And we hope that, you know, we can seed the market with a new generation of investors to the Scout program.
We've got some really interesting questions coming in from our audience. And I want to just pause and take one of those because it touches on something we haven't gotten to yet. And that is a question that comes from Georgia Lopez. She asks, you know, how are you measuring success? Is it a quarterly review, monthly, annually? Are specific goals established to measure success?
Well, I think
I'm happy to jump in. Oh, go ahead, Angela.
I was just going to say, as an LP, you know, private equity is the long game, right? And so you look at a 3 to 5 year outlook in terms of investing, but maybe it could be a 10 year investment, and, you know, and maybe up to 12 years. And so if you see some traction early on, the way we've seen with Base 10 Ventures, who actually came back to market in like 18 months, like my head was blown off, because I felt like I just met with him when he closed his prior fund. And so when you see that traction and then you see the realizations and or events, whatever you want to call it, you know, you have to say that, give that person credit. You know, it's not luck versus skill. He has a track record. And so he's a highly skilled individual. He's a serial entrepreneur. He's put together a dynamic team, and he has the ability to pick winners. And so from an LP perspective, when we're looking at a GP, we like to see things like that. We like to see traction. We like to see that you've executed your strategy. And then in the end, we have high conviction in that individual and what they're building.
I would just add that we'd also look at, you know, where the manager is, you know, in terms of the build out of their team, how they're leveraging their network, really making sure they're thinking about kind of really leveraging all facets of it, you know, even including public policy in some cases. We also like to, you know, we're starting to loosely kind of assess where folks are at in terms of kind of their own racial equity journey. So, you know, some folks will come in very clear, we've got the plan, here it is. And then other folks are like, no, that's not something for us. And we may see the play around, you know, with that lens and bring our manager along. And we have done that several times. We've talked to folks who are not a manager who's explicitly focusing on diversity, but you can see the additionality in the strategy. And so I think for us, it's been really great because it helps us to think about these managers, like in the context of where they're at, kind of in their own development, but also around their KPIs, obviously, and really think about that in partnership with the manager and how we can be additive every year in annual meetings and whatnot.
So for Lisa, and I know Barry wants to chime in on this too, some have advocated using quotas, like committing a percentage of a fund to diverse investments or founders of color, as opposed to having separate dedicated pools for this. For example, this summer, Andreessen Horowitz and SoftBank created funds for these opportunities. Which types of these strategies do you favor? What's the downside of funds dedicated to this versus getting, quote, regular funds to improve their diversity investing?
Yeah, I think you should do both, do all of the above, because, you know, we're so far behind on it for all kinds of reasons. I mean, I'd love to hear Barry's view on, you know, while we're now just seeing diversity in the GP ranks and at the large venture capital firms, but we are so far behind that I think, you know, being explicit as an investor about your recruitment plan and that you're going to bring in associates and you're going to bring in principals and you're going to develop the partners that you bring in, that you're going to invest in the activity rather than talk about it. I mean, it's felt like over the 20 plus years that I've been in the business that we've talked more about it than we've actually done about it. And, you know, as we discussed today, it's really not all that difficult. It's pretty intuitive, right? If you bring in diverse talent, you're going to get diverse portfolios. If you support diverse communities, you're going to have businesses that can thrive in those communities. And so let's just go about doing it. So I think the combination of being focused on hiring diversity, but then also having some targeted funds. We have targeted funds for all kinds of things. We've got biotech funds. We've got, you know, more general healthcare funds. We've got funds on AI. We've got funds on security. Why can't have a fund on a diversity? I mean, this is exactly what I did when I was at Intel, right? I launched a diversity fund. And to be honest with you, I thought post-launching that fund, it was a $125 million fund targeting women and minorities. But I thought post-launching that, that we would see a groundswell of firms following, right? Corporate firms, private venture firms. There was a lot of buzz at that time. This is 2014. There was a lot of buzz about exposing your diversity numbers in the high-tech sector. And so it was a very sensitive topic, very top of mind. And yet it was absolutely no response. There was nobody that follows. Intel Capital was the largest and the only fund that was targeting women and minorities as entrepreneurs, amazingly. And so, you know, now action seems to be beginning, but I think it's largely due to the circumstance that we're seeing, you know, the racial unrest, the riots, and the difficulties that's, I think, brought this to the attention of many more people than really seriously considered it at the time that we did the diversity fund. But the opportunity is as strong now as it was then. And, you know, I think we just need to act. People know what to do. Let's demystify it, right? If you go hire the right people, you're going to get the right portfolios and you're going to get returns ultimately, because the folks in those communities know the communities. They know what the communities want, and they can build products to service those communities. So let's just get on with it, because it really isn't that hard.
Barry?
Yeah, there's no doubt Lisa was a pioneer in this area. And was that 10 years ago, Lisa?
2014, you know, 6 years ago.
The question is, yeah, where have we gone from there? But, you know, listen, I applaud any effort by the industry to move the ball forward. But it seems to me that a lot more has to be done. When you say we're going to dedicate, you know, 1% or whatever the number is of our fund to Black entrepreneurs, who are underrepresented, even if you did 1%, they're still underrepresented, right? Because they're a much larger portion of the population. And so at some point, we've got to start raising the bar. And this is not about doing some small amount of investing in Black entrepreneurs. It's about opening up the opportunity to everybody. And I also think that you don't solve the problem by creating a quota for a homogenous investment team to go off and invest in a diverse set of entrepreneurs. You make more progress by having your investment team be diverse and represent the population. And we've got a long way to go, and it doesn't happen overnight, but it can start happening, right? But that to me is the way to attack the problem, not by setting aside funds with the same old venture group.
I would add that we also need to be thinking about our reframing of what it means to be an LP, right? We're shifting. And I think, you know, there were tons of people that were working well before COVID, and we invested in, and many others who are actually, you know, as well as being underrepresented, have really great strategies and are bringing new lenses. Ethnography as a part of the underwriting, really thinking about that in a much more intentional way, instead of assuming. We assume so much in our investment process. And I think what we're saying is we need to really start to break down and understand what these assumptions are and how they've really left alpha on the table for all of us.
Very well said, Cynthia. I agree with all of this, and I agree that we should probably do both, but I'll tell you for Crucial, I don't think I answered your question as to what our criteria is when you asked earlier. It's more than 50% in terms of ownership on a equity ownership on a firm level. We want to see diverse individuals on an ownership level because we believe that those decisions that those individuals are making will trickle into the portfolio and, you know, close the wealth gap and, you know, do all the things that we're seeing as it relates to social ills and disparities. And
is that 50% by number of owners or by ownership? Because that could still be one person.
Right. It could be one person. So we're doing this as a part of our research process. We want direct access to funds. And so the only time we're actually going to be interested in hiring a fund of funds is if there's something we can't find. For instance, we're in a fund in Africa because we didn't have boots on the ground. We didn't know a lot of local managers, so that made sense. But we like small funds. We like direct relationships, and we'll have a lot of them. We have over 130 clients. And so we want these sorts of individuals to have access to a lot of our client portfolios. I would say today about 87% of our clients' portfolio have at least one diverse manager in it. And that includes our OCIO model. So we have non-discretionary portfolio and discretionary portfolio. And then finally, I'll say of the over $35 billion that we manage, so far, we're north of $4 billion allocated to diverse managers across various asset classes. But we will partner with someone who has a diversity fund, but we rather for that fund to be led by a woman or person of color. And we can have a lot of that.
We have a question from Keegan Phillip that is really nicely framed, and it touches on something we were going to get to. So I'll put it in Keegan's words. There's talk about access as an issue, but it's questionable whether there's really a will to do the work that you're all talking about and that you're all working on. So what Keegan asks is, what would be the best way to hold investors accountable when it comes to investing in diverse founders or giving partners from diverse backgrounds the ability to write checks? I know, for example, one thing that comes to mind is just a couple of weeks ago, Yale University's endowment made a lot of noise by deciding that they were going to hold people accountable, the asset managers that they are working with. So that would seem to be an example. Cynthia, what do you think is the best way to hold professionals in this industry accountable and put some teeth behind this?
What we recommend a lot of folks is, you know, do an audit, right? Look at what you're doing and what you're not doing. You know, so what we do whenever we look at a deal, we say who's benefiting and who isn't. And what I would tell anybody who's thinking about this is think about, like, what are you doing and what aren't you doing? Right? Like, look at your managers, like, look at the trends. You'll start to see what your bias is pretty quickly. Right. And I think then you really start to unpack that. All right. So where can we add additionality? Right. Can this expertise we have and maybe this AI, right, technology, can we expand that and think about, you know, underserved folks and how they might benefit and how they might not? Or, you know, think about what's the harm? What's the harm of this to basically, you know, think about, you know, the folks who are still working right now, right? The essential workers right now, you know, what are the benefits of these products to them? Those lenses, I think, help a little bit more. We try not to put explicit, I don't want to say quotas, but guidelines, but we really want to have a lens because right now we don't know. We really don't know what's coming back. What we're seeing, though, is really amazing stuff like Maven and Coupa and others. But I think the other piece of it too is that we have to start the conversation because, again, we have been leaving so much alpha on the table by overlooking so many markets and individuals. And I think the opportunity now is really for us to dig in, really understand how we've been leaving that alpha on the table, and really starting to engage and listening to these new managers that are coming up. They have been watching all of us longer than we've been aware of them. So they know what decisions they make. They have insights, I think, that can be incredibly valuable. And I think some of the best conversations is when not only do we give the hard feedback to our managers, but when they give it back to us too. And I think that's what's making us as an institution stronger, and also helping us think a little bit more about how we can support the field in these conversations more holistically.
Barry, we had a question from Lauren Usher. It said, what are the top 2 to 3 actions VC firms should take right now to get moving? We've talked a lot about programs, but what about actions?
That's a great question. Number one, figure out ways to provide access on your team to Black, Latinx candidates. Every time there's this thing in football called the Rooney Rule, where anytime there's a head coach opening, that they have to interview a candidate from a Black candidate. I wouldn't suggest we just take that over to venture capital, but I would suggest that any time that you're looking to add an investment team member, you have a set of candidates that are diverse, and you go off and you force yourself to go and find those candidates and develop the network. Because once you develop the network, they're there and it's there. And every time you have a new opening, you can do that. So that's one thing, is you've got to develop the access network. Number two is you got to hire into the team. We do measure our team. We measure what the makeup of our team is, and what it looks like. And we're always, sort of striving to, again, be more closely resemble the population. And number three, you got to track your portfolio companies and the founders and your portfolio companies, the execs, the board, et cetera, and what the makeup of those companies are. And we do track those stats too, and judge yourself by it. Ultimately, you hope that all that stuff translates into better performance. Now, someone mentioned LPs. LPs don't push us enough on this issue. They don't push us on, why are you not more diverse? Why do you not have more Black investors on your team? I've never heard an LP say that to us. Mm. They should. They
you
should
haven't
push
talked
us
to me,
it.
Barry.
Yeah, I know. I wish you should be one of our LPs, for God's sakes. We need more LPs like that. On the other hand, I'm going to ask them about their organizations and how diverse they are, and why don't they have more diversity in their organization. So it goes both ways. This is an ecosystem. This is not just about more Black entrepreneurs. This is an entire innovation ecosystem that needs more representation. So we got to think about these things broadly.
Hey,
thank
Barry,
you, Angela, for doing that.
Barry, just to follow up, in my introduction, I said that Alec fed me the stat, but you opened Lightspeed in the 1990s. Were you always this way? If not, how have you actually transitioned?
No, we were mostly white males for a long time, like most venture firms. I don't think there was a Black venture capitalist in the 1990s. I don't know, Lisa, do you know? I don't think there was
no.
One. There was zero.
There was right? Zero.
There was zero.
It's still not many more than zero right now.
Yeah,
but
it's not many more than zero, but it's not much. It was about 5 years ago we started looking at diversity as an advantage, as a competitive advantage for us, and what it meant. And we started thinking about it in the context of more female partners. And obviously we went from 1 to 10. But more and more, we're thinking about it more broadly as Black, Latinx, LGBTQ, military veterans, all the folks who are underrepresented in our industry. We want to reach a broad set of entrepreneurs. And if we can do that, we're going to outperform.
Can I just add one thing? Two things. One, the Rooney Rule. While I commend people for starting there, that's what it is. It's a start. So yeah. We have to tap into those networks. So I agree with you. But the Rooney Rule to me is cute. It's like having one Black friend. We want to make sure you're not just checking the box and moving on. And also, diversity is not defined by a bunch of white women, right? So we have to think about multiculturalism or intersectionality when we're thinking about diversity.
Angela, yeah, I totally agree with you 100%. And by the way, on the Rooney Rule, there's a really important point here, is having one person from a diverse group on your team is not solving diversity. In fact, it almost makes it worse. If you don't have 3 or 4 or 5 or more, you're not really solving the problem. You're making it very uncomfortable for that person.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's true.
About belonging, right? That's the belonging piece of making sure that we retain these people in these industries and in these funds, right? Because it's not just getting them the room, it's making sure they feel valued, seen,
and actually engaged and with autonomy, not just putting them in there and tokenizing them and putting them out to LPs to listen. I can tell exactly when you were bringing your Black friend in, you know, and I, you know, and that turns LP off, right? Because it's like, don't perform, just be who you are, right? If you don't know you're on your journey, say that. That's right. Where your gap is. There's that, we don't judge you. When we ask the question, we're not asking to get you. We're trying to ask so we understand where you're at and how we can be supportive of you as an LP in your life cycle.
That's right. And start thinking about talent acquisition and fire your freaking recruiter if they're not doing what you're asking. And also your consultant, if they're not bringing you a diverse set of GPs or funds to consider, fire them.
Lisa, so you did something
just,
too.
Just on the point of the literal point of there were no black investors. Obviously, it was tongue in cheek. There were, but the fact that we can name them probably is indicative of the problem that we're really trying to make the point around. There just aren't enough, and one or two or three or even 100 in an industry that employs millions, when you include venture capital and private equity in the LP business, as well as the entrepreneurs themselves, you know, millions, it's just not enough. You're not going to go after those markets without it. And unless there's accountability, there's not going to be change. You know, the LPs do broadly, and the big LPs need to hold the GPs accountable. And vice versa. I agree with Barry's point on that. But right now, there's no accountability. There's no cost for not having a diverse investment team. None whatsoever. And so if there's no cost without having it, complacency is the enemy of change, right? They're complacent. Things are going pretty well. Thank you very much. Why do I need to change? And so there's not accountability on either side. And I think right now, because of the you know, kind of the social environment that we're living in, people are taking it more seriously, but there was no reason for firms not to take it seriously 5 years ago or 10 years ago. We just hope that it stays and it doesn't wane as the social unrest settles, because we really are missing an opportunity. We really aren't fulfilling our mandate to service these underrepresented, these underserved markets if we're not diversifying our teams. It's a dereliction of duty, in my view, not just a social or racial issue.
Speaking of the social unrest and the political atmosphere that we're in, we just had the election. It is over, depending on who you ask. But how does the election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris affect the landscape going forward? Do you expect anything to change when they are in there and doing their jobs, their next jobs?
It better change. Something had better change. I think that we put a lot on Obama when he was in office, and it truly took him two terms to do what he probably wanted to do, needed to do. And he was just blocked from so many things that could have really benefited the Black and Brown community. But with this current administration, look, I think we've all heard on the news how Black women came out and voted and really represented the Biden-Harris ballot. And so if they don't listen, and I think they are, because they're talking a good talk right now, shame on them. And I think that Black people in general, at least, okay, I'll speak for me, we're so patient, you know, we're so kind in a lot of ways. But I love the protests that I saw in the streets. What I saw was an overwhelming amount of diversity. It wasn't your protest from the 60s. There was diversity in these crowds. People are tired. They want change. And then finally, I'll say, I could say a lot on this, but the state of Oregon, when I saw them protesting and the history that lies there, I said, okay, something has to happen now. I hope it's not momentum, but if it is, I'm going to do as much as I can to ride this wave right now. But I hope that we're finally here as a nation.
Well, we've been hearing a lot of really promising things around the transition and the kinds of questions that the transition team is asking. And it feels like there are a lot of focus on making sure that in this reconstruction, quite frankly, that that racial equity, diversity is paramount. So I think to Angela's point, yes, you know, I think the numbers as they still come out show a really interesting story and a new story that we haven't seen in past elections. And so I think that's going to be, you know, a lot of the guiding forces around the decisions that they make. I've heard some great things out of HUD and the SEC around small business. And so I think, you know, we'll probably see some really good pieces, you know, hopefully, you know, Yale level or more. But I think, again, we're going to have to be in a rebuilding mode. And I think this is where we again, 10 years ago, we were in innovation mode. So this time, let's think about making sure we get good representation while we build all of these, this next wave of new companies and businesses.
Agreed. Lisa, and I think, can I just add one more thing? I think we have to be comfortable about words like, well, if you mean rebuilding as a nation, okay, but rebuilding and recovering for my community, can we just build? And can we just, you know, is this the next wave of the civil rights movement where we talk about economic opportunity? When are we going to get there? There's no rebuilding for us. And I understand clearly what you're saying, Cynthia, and I agree, but there's no rebuilding and no recovery. I mean, we haven't been a part of this nation that we have built, that my ancestors have helped to build. And so, again, I hope it's not momentum. I'm really excited about this current administration. And I don't know, let's just all pray that we're in a different place today.
Lisa, going from, I know you're sitting in the US, but you do work for, I believe, an organization that's British. Do you have any insights into maybe how our diversity journey is going versus what you've seen from your British counterparts?
Yeah, it is a lot different just because the demographics are different there. I think underrepresented minorities there are more Middle East, Indian, not so much African American. I think the population of African American there is, you know, less than 3%, so it's pretty small. But they do feel and are experiencing a lot of the same, you know, social concerns, the lack of opportunity, the lack of exposure, lack of capital from those groups. So I think, you know, at least our company is serious about its diversity mandate. We've done pretty well at National Grid, ranked amongst the best employers of women and in the top list of Forbes for diversity just in general. So I think they do a good job, but it's a different dynamic than in the US. The US just has a different history, but I do think they're serious about trying to correct the problems. The venture capital community there is a little smaller as well, so but it's as homogenous as it is here. So they still have the same challenges. They're just the pressure points are different for them.
Yeah, and apologies, I should have attributed that question to Dr. Jillian Marcel, who posed that for you.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk for a second about resources that you guys think are particularly valuable in the work you're doing. And we actually have a question from Emily Hostage, I think it is, on this subject. Are there also communities or professional organizations that you would recommend for guidance, feedback, office hours, et cetera, from active asset managers?
Organizations?
Culture Shift. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, you go ahead. You got it. Go ahead.
That's on my list. Go ahead, Cynthia. You've got it.
So we were going to say, Angela and I will recommend Culture Shift Labs. They are a great institution. They've been holding these sessions, and it's a great organization group to go and meet just who's out there. I met Base 10 out there a couple of years ago, and many of the others that we've been looking at in the portfolio. So that's a great partner. And I also have been noticing that there are these various affinity groups that are bubbling up, and many of these larger institutions are a part of them, and they're basically by race. So there's a Black one, there's a Latino one, there's a Native one, and so they're starting to percolate. And so we're trying to figure out how to kind of raise those conversations up so they can be engaged. So hopefully from this dialogue and some other activities, we'll be able to connect them to more folks.
There's a ton of incubators, accelerators. I have not missed a culture shifting weekend event in 3 years since I've come to know about it. And we put dollars to this. So I have a huge budget as it relates to partnering with those organizations, because we want access to resources. We want to show up on panels. We want to get the word out. We want people to know that we're approachable. And so in other asset classes, and I'm starting to see more venture capitalists at NAIC, National Association for Investment Companies. I see VCs there now. As of last year, I was surprised because I typically see a lot of public pension plans there. And, you know, venture capital funds, at least in the ones that I've been sourcing, they're very small funds. So I'm happy to see LPs like myself and family offices that can actually be attracted to those sorts of fund sizes. Then there's NASP, National Association for Securities Professionals, all of these trade organizations, SEO, TWIGO, they actually have some great advice to give to GPs. And so I think we should tap into those networks. Also HBCU, they have a venture capital initiative or fund. I think it's a simple Google search at this point. That's what I did when I found my first conference. And then when you tap into those networks, you're invited to dinners and small symposiums and forums, and then the world just opens up.
We should also mention Black VC,
yes.
Latinx VC.
Yes, I was on a call with Latinx VC the other night.
And Venture Forward, a foundation that's focused on more diversity and venture capital.
Yeah, there's a group called Blacks in Technology as well. It's one of the largest organizations dedicated to bringing more people of color into the technology industry. So not focused specifically on venture capital, but bringing more Blacks into tech, which would feed our entrepreneur pipeline and potentially our venture capital pipeline. They've got chapters all over the U.S. and they host an annual conference that brings in more than 1,000 people. So there are plenty of organizations, professional networks that we could tap into if we want to.
MLT is another one.
Yeah. Black in Tech is a huge conference. And finally, Black Women Talk Tech. Huge. I'm a sponsor. Never miss that one either.
But apparently with all these organizations, there's a pipeline problem. So now people know where to go.
Right.
And, you know,
so I think
there's a conference going on right now with Afrotech, which I don't know if some of you are, you know, the great conference, a lot of conversations going on right there out of Blavity, which is a media company that's doing a lot of really interesting conversations in the Black community. And so I think, you know, also look at Black media. You really start to get a vibe, start looking at the different media and really, like, quite frankly, I use Twitter a lot. I use Twitter to really learn about, you know, what's happening in these conversations. And, you know, over the last couple of years, just seeing the proliferation of these groups just sprout out. And I think the thing that we all should keep in mind is as these groups get larger, their agency is going to get larger and they're going to start to ask us to do more and to be different. So I think we have to think about that as well.
Well, this is actually, sorry, Alec, if I steal your thunder, but I think it's a good place to end in terms of optimistic places you can go to look and find solutions to these problems. I know Barry has a call he needs to get to. Closing comments from anybody? Anything we totally skipped that you wanted to make sure we talked about?
I'll just say one thing real quick. I think there's optimism on this panel, as you can probably hear from the tone and the energy around it. I think we all believe that we're moving in a direction that could be helpful to our industry, but more broadly to, you know, entrepreneurs and consumers who want to see tech products in their community. So I'm optimistic more than I was 5 or 6 years ago when I launched the Diversity Fund. I think there is real change that's happening, and this panel I think is a good representation of that change. So stay encouraged. It's going to get better.
Thank you so much to Lisa, Barry, Angela, Cynthia, colleague Hillary. Have a good day, everybody, and be well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All. Thank you. Thank you. Great job.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Invisible Capital. Please rate and review the show to help others discover it, and stay tuned for season 3 of the podcast coming soon. For more information, visit pitchbook.com/podcast.